This is episode 302 of the Flip Empire Show.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
What's going on, superstars? This is Alex Pardo. I'm your host of the Flip Empire Show. If you are joining me for the first time, I should say joining us, thank you. Welcome home. I appreciate you taking the time to tune into this podcast where my aim and my goal is always to deliver as much valuable content and provide as much value to you and your business so that you can create the kind of business that you strive for and that you want so that you can live the type of lifestyle that you desire and that you're after. And it's my goal and my aim to help you get there through these episodes. You're about to listen to a masterclass episode with Fernando Angelucci, who is an absolute stud and rock star in every sense of the word. Guy's 27 years old. He got started in his business at 22, and he's got a whole wholesaling operation that does about 50 deals a year, and he has traded in his single family rentals for self-storage facilities. So in this episode, we get into the specifics of how he built his business and how he continues to do joint venture partnerships and why giving is so much, I don't want to say it's so much more important than receiving, but how he gets so much more in return now because he's got an abundant mindset, because he's abundant with his time, with his money. He's extremely generous. He's constantly helping people, willing to give away 50% of a deal in order to just do a volume of wholesale deals and wholesale transactions. So we get into that, and that's kind of a common theme throughout the show. But we talk about how he was able to expand his wholesaling business into multiple markets, how he's put people in place so that that business runs without him, and how he was able to essentially bridge the gap between wholesaling, which is a transactional business, over to self-storage facilities. And so his first two self-storage facilities, he ended up wholesaling. He saw the numbers, and then he made the pivot a couple of years ago and now has acquired two different self-storage facilities. We talk about how he was able to get into those deals with no money out of his pocket. Matter of fact, how he was able to put a $30,000 acquisition fee in his pocket, how they're cash flowing and how they're doing. And so just a really, really sharp guy. I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. And again, if you're new, thank you. I think you're going to get a lot out of this. And if you are a seasoned vet here in the Flip Empire Show, I love you. I appreciate you. And thank you for sticking with me. And so without further ado, let's jump into this episode with Fernando Angelucci. Fernando, how you doing, my friend? How's it going?
I'm doing well, Alex. Yourself?
Doing great, buddy. Doing great. I'm glad we recently connected. I'm pumped to have you on. You and I were just talking. I think this is going to be a very interesting podcast from the perspective of, like I was telling you, the last year and a half, wholesaling has always been, our core business model going back 12, 13 years when I got in this business. And I've been guilty of, at some point, you kind of get addicted to the money and the income from wholesaling, and you get caught in the business rat race of just transaction after transaction after transaction. And you try to blow up this business and you get it bigger and bigger and you just want to scale. But the last year and a half, I've really seen the light. And I took a pause in inventory. I said, I got into this business for freedom, for wealth, for cash flow, right? And wholesaling is great, but it's a transactional business. And it can be automated to a certain degree, but it doesn't provide the kind of wealth that other avenues, other niches when real estate can provide. And I'm excited to have you on because you still have an active wholesaling business. You were telling me that you guys still do about 50 deals a year, but the last, handful of years, you were buying single family rentals. And then really the core focus, it sounds, for you guys the last 2-3 years has been the self-storage facilities, right?
Yeah. So we kind of went through the whole progression. We started off as wholesale. We still have the wholesale business running. From there, we've seen a bunch of great deals. So we started buying single family and multifamily properties. We started flipping deals as well.
Okay.
And then we just took a deep dive down into, what do we need to focus on? What's the most value for our time? And we found self-storage facilities. I was walking through a REI expo in Indiana.
Okay.
And I peeked my head into a room and Scott Myers was talking, which he's in Collective Genius with us.
Great dude. I love that guy.
And the numbers he was putting out on the screen just was, they were blowing me away. And then, all the problems I was having with my rentals, he's like, yeah, that doesn't apply to self-storage. That doesn't apply to self-storage. That doesn't. I was like, all right, I'm sitting down. Like I sat right in the front row and immediately went to his boot camp and got his mentorship. And then we started buying deals. First, we started wholesaling self-storage deals so okay. that I could feel comfortable with the numbers. Then we started buying the facilities ourselves.
Okay. And just to kind of take a few steps back, when did you get started in this business?
Yeah. So I'll go all the way back. So when I was 16 years old, I was given a copy of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That's when I knew I'm going to be a real estate investor, right?
Yeah.
However, when I told my parents that I didn't want to go to college, my dad basically was like, over my dead body, you're going to go to college. And not only are you going to go to college, you're going to get an engineering degree. Because if anything doesn't work out with the business,
wow.
then at least you can fall back on that degree. So I took, okay. you know, in my eyes, I took a little break, you know, ended up graduating with an ag bioengineering degree with technical systems management. And then I went to Iowa to start working with a Fortune 50 company. And from there, I started wholesaling on the side until okay. I basically matched my salary with wholesale money. And that was only me doing it on the weekends and at nights, right? So I was like, you know what, let's do this full time. I see a huge potential to make money here. And then also the biggest thing was to free up my time. I was working, I was a salaried employee, so I didn't have hours. But my hours ended up working out to be around 5 a.m. to about 8:30 p.m. Every day. So I was working some serious hours.
Fernando, so we have, you probably don't know this about me because I know we recently met. We have an instant connection and I'll tell you why. So coming out of college, I took a job with GE. One of my goals was to work for a Fortune 500 company and I wanted to be this future CEO, CFO. I ended up getting a job in their financial management program. Prior to that, I was actually a computer engineering major. And the math was just, it was challenging. I ended up switching to finance and MIS. So we kind of have that in common. And the wholesaling income, my first deal was what replaced my salary at GE. And I was averaging 70, 80 hours a week working in the finance department at GE. So I could relate, man. I understand exactly. So hearing your story, it's touching certain parts of my story, man. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. It's tough, man. So God bless you. God bless you for following through, getting that engineering degree and, you know, kind of honoring your dad's wishes. You know what I love about your story is that I think so many of us, you know, I think back, there's so many stories I can think of where they lived the life that somebody else wanted them to live, whether it's their parents, loved ones. And yet you still did what your dad wanted you to do. But at the end of the day, you ended up following the path that you wanted to take. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that? Because I know for a fact, Fernando, there's people listening to the show that are not happy doing what they're doing. And maybe some of those people are living somebody else's life or they're living the life that their parents want them. So can you kind of specifically talk to those people?
Yeah. So I'll kind of back up a little bit. So both of my parents are immigrants from Brazil.
Okay.
And they got out of Brazil during a time when there was, you know, some serious hyperinflation. There wasn't a lot of job opportunity versus in the United States. So they both came here. They actually met in Chicago. And when I came along, you know, they had the American dream, quote unquote, in their head. You come here, you get good grades, you go get a good job with a company, you work there for 40 years, and then you retire with a pension.
Yeah,
we all know that's not the case anymore. It's very difficult to find any jobs that pay a pension, let alone, you know, a 401k match or what have you. So, you know, when I was going to my parents and I said, hey, you know, I don't think I want to go to college. They were still very stuck on that. You have to go to college. You have to get a good job. But if this is what you want to do, at least you'll have something to fall back on. So when I was working for this Fortune 50 company all throughout college, I was very interested in entrepreneurship. I read the Rich Dad Poor Dad when I was 16. When I was 19, I ran a painting company called College Works Painting. It's like one of these you know, around the nation type companies where they come, they mentor you on how to start a business. And then, you know, on the weekends when all my friends were partying down at U of I would take a bus up to Chicago and I'd start knocking on doors Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Respect.
Booking paint jobs for the summer. And then I would come back down and then work on the business after my classes at, you know, at U of I. and then did very well. I learned a lot about business from that experience at a low, you know, at a young age where the stakes weren't that high. I still had a place to live if something didn't work out. You know, it wasn't my. So when I finally got to that Fortune 50 company I worked for, I was just stuck and I wasn't feeling good. Not, you know, I wasn't feeling good about my health because I was in a car from 5 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. every day.
Yeah, it was a sales job, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sales job. You know, I'd drive across the eastern half of Iowa from I-35 to the Mississippi River. And it was just to the point where something I didn't really like, it was something that I didn't believe in what I was selling.
Yeah.
So that makes it very difficult when you're not motivated.
You know? That's a whole separate podcast, right? As in anybody out there in sales, you have to be an evangelist of your product. You have to buy into it. Otherwise, you're not doing yourself any service and you're definitely not doing your customers any service. So not to go off on a tangent, but I'm glad you said that because that's so critical to your success in sales and in anything.
Yeah. So then I looked at my situation and I took a method out of a page of Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek, which is called Fear Setting, where you will put together two scales, 0 to 10 on both of the scales. The top one being, if I do the thing that I want to do, how much of an impact will it make on me negatively if everything goes wrong? You know, 0 being no impact at all, 10 being I die, 9 being I go to prison for life, right? Okay. What I found when I was throwing around the idea of quitting my job was, the impact would be maybe a 3. Like if everything failed, I still had the ability to move back in with my parents. I wouldn't be on the streets. I wouldn't be starving. You know, there was kind of a
safety net
because I started young. Yeah, there was a safety net. But then when I did on the positive effect, it was a 10 for me. It would be a freedom of time, freedom of money, spend time with whoever I want, travel wherever I want. I said, you know what, this is worth it. Then the biggest thing, which is going to speak to those people that you're talking about out there that maybe they're in a position they want to get out of, but they don't quite have the push to go to that next level.
Yeah.
What I found out is I was still comfortable. I was comfortable enough where I was like, oh, you know, being an investor would be great, but like I'm getting a paycheck comes in every month and, you know, I got a nice apartment and a truck and maybe, you know, it's not that bad. So what I found out is I'm somebody that's very intrinsically motivated.
Okay.
And situations when I need to hold myself accountable and have no way of failing, I use the analogy. I'm going to jump out of the airplane without the parachute, and then I'm going to have to build the parachute on the way down because I'm going to build that parachute before I hit the ground, right?
That's right. That's right.
So what I decided to do is to say, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to quit my job. And that way, now I have nothing to fall back on financially. I have to succeed in the real estate investing.
Burn the ships. Yeah.
Burn the ship. So I burned everything. And that's when my business started to really take off and started really to grow by multiples is when I finally decided to say, hey, you know what? This is it. This is the end all be all. I'm not going to keep holding on to these safety nets that are all around me. Let's just go straight into it and really commit.
So, man, number one, respect and hats off to you for grinding and hustling when a lot of people were out partying, because that takes sacrifice and commitment. And I don't necessarily know or think that you would be where you are today without having that experience. So, you know, congratulations, man, because I respect that mentality, especially when it's too easy not to do what's difficult, right? And number two, there's so much to unpack and so many nuggets that you just shared. Number one, I've read, was it the 4-Hour Workweek where you found out about that? It's called Fear Setting, you said?
Fear Setting, yeah, 4-Hour Workweek.
Dude, what's crazy is I've probably read that book 2 or 3 times and I must have missed that page. And which speaks to just why it's so important to go back and reread books that have really resonated with you. So that's a nugget you shared. But number three, I love the fact that you're so self-aware and you said, I know that I'm motivated intrinsically and I know that I need to put myself in an uncomfortable position and environment in order to succeed. I think so many people, they get comfortable with being comfortable and yet they don't stretch themselves. And you came from, I don't know, was your family middle class, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. When my parents first came over to the United States, we were definitely not middle class. I'd say now they're middle class.
Okay.
But my parents sacrificed a lot to, you know, make sure I went to good schools.
Yeah.
Get a house in a place that had good public schools that really worked. I saw that hustle from both my parents growing up and how, You know, my dad would always tell me, no one's going to take care of you. So it's, you have to take care of yourself. You have to go for what you want.
Yeah, smart, wise man. And I love the fact, and the reason I ask about middle class, because we share so much in common. I think if you come from a middle class family, I think if anything, it's more challenging, because the people that come from poverty or don't have much, they just have this mentality when they're ambitious that they're going to go get it, right? And yet I think, and in the wealthy, they have, you know, some certain access to resources and people and some money. And so that definitely helps them. But I think the middle class, it's, they're stuck in that comfort. And I think the first step for people, if you find yourself in that position, is, you know, do what Fernando just suggested, is go through that exercise, put yourself out there. And sometimes you got to burn the ship, you know, you got to jump off the cliff and build the wings on the way down, or jump out of the plane and build the parachute, like you said. So thank you for sharing that, because I think it gives people context as to what we're about to get into, which is now, you know, this is going for how far back that you graduated, that you were doing your wholesaling hustle on the side?
Yeah, so I'm 27 right now. So I started the wholesaling business.
You're a baby, man. You're a baby, dude. Oh, amazing, man. Congratulations, man. That's amazing.
Thanks,
so you started at 22. You're 27. Talk to me about building the bridge between the wholesaling, because it seemed like you started, you know, achieving success pretty early on with the wholesaling. Talk to me about bridging the gap from wholesaling to single family rentals, and then we can transition into the self-storage facilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, started the wholesale campaign. I really went in depth. I'll tell you actually how I started the business. I ended up pulling out. So in one night, I applied for like 64 credit cards. I don't recommend this to you guys, but
64?
I applied for 64. On the first round, I got 8 approved. And of those 8, I cash advanced like $95,000 off of it, just into my checking account. And that's how I started with my initial capital to start marketing for wholesale properties. I didn't know if it was gonna work, but I knew I had to pay bills. I only had enough money for rent for like 3 months after that and groceries. So I knew I had to succeed. We did our first campaign. It went well. Then I started scaling up. It immediately started making terrible mistakes. I lost like 30 grand on one of my, and that was credit card 30 grand that I lost.
Yeah. So you're probably getting hit with like 18 to 25% interest or something stupid, right?
So in the beginning, there were 0% credit cards, but after month 12, then the interest started kicking in, right?
Fair enough. Fair
So did the marketing, started doing the boots on the ground, started getting deals. The very first couple of deals that I got, I did terrible. The underwriting was, I just did not do it very well, but that's all a part of learning, right? In the beginning,
sure.
It's all about failing often and failing quickly and learning from those and then moving forward, right?
100%.
So started getting good deals in. Then I started, after I started getting a few wholesale, I started to see the deals that my investors were buying from me. And I'll go back. One of the things that I always tell their wholesalers to do is, after about 6 months, 12 months, go back on that deal and call that investor that bought it and say, hey, how'd you do? Give me your numbers. I just want to compare with what I thought I was doing. Great. And that not only helped me gauge how well I was estimating my repair costs and how long the time to sell would be or what the rents would be that I forecasted, but then I started to see how much money these guys are making. I was just like, oh my gosh, like I'm leaving a lot of money on the table as a whole. You know, like you said, we get addicted to these big checks that we get every time we do a wholesale.
What was your average wholesale deal at that point? And then how much were your fix and flip investors making?
Yeah. So my average wholesale fee at that time is when I was still in Iowa was about $5,000, over $5,000.
And I'm sorry, did you say this is in Chicago, Fernando?
No, this is when I first started. I was in Des Moines, Iowa.
Okay. Des Moines, Iowa. Got it.
Yeah. So my very first deal, I actually co-wholesaled with a fellow CG member. He was my mentor out there, Mark Lane.
Oh, nice. Good dude.
So we sold the first deal for a $5,000 fee. I took $2,500. And you know, when I started calling back these investors, I started seeing that on their flips, they were making like 25, 30, 35, 40 grand. On the rentals, they were pulling in, you know, 8 to 12% cap rates yearly. And some of the, you know, worse areas, they're hitting like 16-18% annual returns on very little invested. And then so I would ask them, I was like, okay, this is a rental property. How much of your own money is actually in the deal? Mm-hmm. How much is bank money? How much is investor money? How much is your own money? And I started finding out that a lot of these buy and hold guys, they're only putting like 5% or less of their own money. The rest of the down payment was coming from investors they were partnering with. So then I started learning partnering, very important. Partner to learn. No, it doesn't make any sense being 100% owner when you can spread the risk around a lot of people. And then also now you get to tap all the knowledge of people that are smarter than you and learn from them on a partnership deal. So they're going to give you everything. They're not going to hold anything back. Right.
Dude, I'm glad. Really quick, let me just kind of piggyback on what you said, because I think a lot of people listening have the mentality that they want 100% of the grape versus 50% of the watermelon. It's that mentality, right? And I think when you work with people, you JV, you partner, you kind of spread the risk, you learn, you can, especially as you're getting started and your business is just not as mature yet, that's a fantastic way to really start to kind of scale up and do more deals.
Yeah. So fast forward about a year into my wholesaling career, got a 5-flat across my desk for $40,000 cash.
I'm sorry, you got a what?
A 5-flat. So a five unit apartment building came across my desk, and all I needed was 40K cash to buy the property is what we negotiated. So I went out to my network. I said, hey guys, who wants to partner with me on this? I'll do all the management. I'll do everything, but I don't have the capital. Does anybody have 40K that they're willing to give me to do a 50-50 partnership, and I'll get your money out as soon as possible? And I had one of my partners to this day, an amazing guy, his name's Paul Hopkins. Now he works at a private equity fund and he does his own fix and flip properties. He does all his own investments, but he was the guy that first gave me my first partnership opportunity. And he, you know, he's a fellow engineer, he's a civil engineer. So we ended up going to get that property. All 5 units were rented. They were cash flowing. We were making very decent returns, I think around like 10 or 12%. And then I was able to sell the property about a year and a half later for like $48,000 for all cash sale. So gave him all his money back plus the increase in value. So I gave him all the appreciation. And then I just got to take 50% of the cash flow. But the money wasn't the important part. The important part was I learned how to be a property manager for the first time in my life.
Experience.
Like I thought it was going to be easy, and it wasn't, right? So
property management can be a beast, dude. That is, God bless property managers out there. So
eventually, like after I learned, then I said, hey, I got to bring in a professional. So again, partnering, right? And then we hired a property management company to start taking over. And then I would ask Paula, my property manager, I'd say, hey, Paula, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? What is the reason that you underwrite for this, you know, amount of take home pay versus rent? And so she started to tell me, as a, you know, experienced property manager, here's the reason I do these things, and that's why I'm doing them on your property, to help you increase your rents and lower your expenses, you know, and to manage the tenants. So it was a great learning experience. So that was my first buy and hold deal. It was a 5-unit that I bought for $40,000, about an hour south of Des Moines, Iowa.
Okay.
So then continue to wholesale. The wholesale, at this point, I'm making maybe 80 to 90,000 a year from the wholesaling, but it's a struggle because my market was very tiny. So Des Moines, Iowa, you know, you had Mark Lane there that was basically taking down the entire, he was the wholesaler. So like
monopolizing the city. Huh?
Yeah. So I'll get properties under contract, and not only would like Mark Lane, or I'll get sellers to meet me at the property. And not only would like Mark Lane and 3 other wholesalers appear at my off-market property, but then 4 or 5 of my cash buyers would also be there. And I was like, how am I going to win this bid, right? Yeah. So then I decided, hey, let's open up some other markets that are larger and still have a very good chance for wholesaling. So we opened up Indianapolis, which is awesome. They have, I think, about 1.2 million people in the metro area, maybe a little bit more. And then we also opened up Chicago. I brought my now partner on, who's one of my best friends. You know, As friends do, every time I got a wholesale check, I'd take a picture of it and I'd send it to him. I was like, how much money do you make today? I made $5,000. And after about a couple months of this, he finally got fed up. He's like, you're going to teach me how to do this, or you're going to stop sending me these pictures of these checks. And I was like, I'll teach you how to do it.
I like it.
So we opened up the Chicago market. Now we're talking, you know, you have something crazy like 9 million people in the metro area, right? So now,
let me quickly ask you this, Fernando. As you were opening up this market, were you hiring and getting boots on the ground? Because some people have a challenge scaling their own business in their local market. Here you are, you went from Des Moines, Iowa, and then you bounced over to Indianapolis and then Chicago. It's like, were you hiring and just quickly growing the team, or how'd you go about that process?
Yeah. So again, I'm very partnership focused. I love doing partnerships, whether it's somebody that has money or expertise or boots on the ground. So instead of hiring, I would actually just give them joint venture on that market. They would be a part owner. So when we came up to Chicago, I split all my companies in the Chicago market with Stephen Ware, my partner. And then he was my boots on the ground there. Same thing with when we went out to Indianapolis. I had a lot of partners out there that I would basically do a joint venture with. In Iowa, I was teaching wholesalers, new wholesalers, how to do what I was doing. And they would take either referral fees or they would take a percentage of each one of the deals that we closed that they brought. Okay. So that was the easiest way because, you know, in the beginning, as a wholesaler, you don't have a lot of liquid capital. All the capital you have goes right back into marketing.
That's right.
You don't have a lot of,
or at least it should, right?
It should, right. Yeah. So I didn't have a lot of the disposable income to hire somebody per se, but I did have time and an abundance mentality to be able to say, like, I'll spend 3 hours with you a day. I'll show you what I do. And, you know, I'll even give you some startup capital to start doing your own marketing. And then you should start taking the profits from that and doing your own marketing. And we could partner on those deals. I found that because I had a large cash buyer list, it was very easy for me to partner with new wholesalers. So I would just teach them what I'll do. They would get deals under contract at good prices if they follow what I said. And then if they needed help selling it to, you know, a cash buyer, they'd come to me. So I always told them, I said, hey, build your own cash buyer list. If you're able to move the deal on your own, good. I don't need any portion of that check.
Okay.
But I know eventually, because I taught you how to do this, eventually you're going to have a deal that is a good deal that you're not going to be able to move because you don't have the right cash buyer for it, that zip code or that type of property. And then you're going to remember who was abundant with their time with me. They're going to remember Fernando was. They're going to call him and say, Fernando, I got a deal that I need you to help me move and we'll split the profits, right? So it's funny. People always ask me when I'm teaching them, you know, when mentors, you know, when potential mentees, if you will, call me to help mentor them on wholesaling, they always, at one point in time, they always ask me about, you know, in hour two or three, they're like, why are you doing this? Like, what is your real motivation? And I always tell them frankly, like, I'm doing this because I'm selfish. I know that if I help you for free, eventually one day from now, you're going to remember my abundance and you're going to call me and I'm going to make money off a deal I didn't have to market before.
So smart, man. Let me just recognize you for a second because we share the same mindset. You have to focus on other people giving value with no expectation in return, but the law of reciprocation always kicks in or generally kicks in. You know, it's the Gary V approach of jab, 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 right hook, you know, give, 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 give. And then eventually it's just going to come back to you, man. So I love that mentality, dude. Love it.
It has happened to me so many times now. And at crazy scales, you know, tenfold. I have a couple partners here in the Chicago market that I've been teaching how to wholesale for the last year or two. I've already done 4 or 5 deals with each of them. That's all deals that I never had to market for just because, you know, they have their own buyers, but if their own buyers don't, if they just don't have the appetite for that deal, they give me a call. And now I got a deal that I can partner with.
Have you considered, Fernando, at any point starting up a meetup group and then just, you know, just a once a month, a meetup group, just giving content, building an audience, and then just having people funnel deals back to your wholesale operation?
Yeah, it's on my to-do list. So right now what I've been doing is just kind of going to other people's meetup groups and, you know, hopefully speaking or presenting deals. And then afterwards, I'm a very face-to-face kind of, not very rigid, but like more just go with the flow kind of guy. Sure. So if you come up to me and you say, hey, Fernando, I really like what you're talking about. I was wondering if you can give me a couple of tips on X, Y, Z. I'll say, hey, how about this? Let's go sit down. So I have, you know, I can make sure I have enough time for you. Let's spend 3 or 4 hours. You know, if you buy me a beer or two, I'll tell you everything I do, literally everything. I'll give you all my contracts, my purchase agreements. I'll give you my assignment contracts. I'll show you literally everything I do because I know one day you're going to get a deal and you're going to bring it to me.
Amazing. Amazing. And there's not too many people like you, man. And that's awesome. I love that. So at this point, you know, you've opened up 3 markets, you're wholesaling. At what point did you jump over to single family rentals? Cause I know at some, you were fixing and flipping as well, right?
Yeah. So the first buy and hold was a multifamily.
That's right.
Then I, again, my first flip deal was with a partnership. So I had a guy, actually his name is Guy Varble. He's super abundance mentality. He was one of my cash buyers and he saw one of the deals that I had for wholesale. He said, hey, Fernando, how about instead of me paying you your $5K assignment fee, what if we go 50-50 on this property as a fix and flip deal? And I was like, you know, a guy that's really nice, but I don't have the money to contribute for the fix and flip. He said, no, your contribution is finding the deal and your $5K assignment fee. And I was like, this is crazy because like, this is not fair to you. You know, like you're giving me so much. And he said, you know what? I'm a abundance mentality guy. I think this is going to pay off in the long run. So he did our first flip with me and I ended up making like three or four times what I would have made as a wholesale. And again, the most important thing was not the money. It was I learned how to do flips, how to manage. And I learned a lot of lessons on that flip. There's a lot of bumps along the ride, which were great because I got to see the worst case scenario on my very first deal, you know? And now guess what? Guy partners with me on self storage deals. We're partners to this day.
Isn't it incredible, man, how it comes full circle, right? That's why I'm always telling people, it doesn't sound sexy, focus on relationships, you know, network, build the right relationships, because when you focus on others, it always comes full circle, man.
Yeah. Did that flip. Then at this point, I'm already in the Chicago market. I don't live there yet. I end up moving here about 3.5 years ago, and then give half my companies to Steven. Steven gives half his companies to me. We partner on the whole thing. And then now we got a big wholesale funnel coming in. I mean, we're looking at, you know, close to 50 deals a week. And we start to see these single family portfolios that are coming across our desks on the south suburbs. We're getting a lot of volume of deals coming in, around 50 deals or so. And we start making offers in a way that not a lot of wholesalers do. Most wholesalers, they make a cash offer and that's it. What we started doing is a multiple option offer where we'd actually make three offers on the same property. We'd make a cash offer, we'd make a short-term seller finance offer, and then we'd make a long-term seller finance offer. Then all of a sudden we get a guy that he wants to take the short-term seller finance offer, a three-year seller finance, where we only had to put like 10% down. Okay. And I was like, this is going to be a great deal. We can do, you know, it's cash flowing like $400 a month after debt service per door. Let's jump on these. So we went in again. We partnered. So the down payments that we needed on the houses, we went to one of our investors that worked with us. We said, "Hey, partner with us on this. We'll give you 50% of the cash flow. Half of that will be principal payment towards you. The other half will be your profit distributions." And we took down our first three single family homes. And this was after we already did three multifamily properties. So we kind of went backwards. Did multifamily, and then we went into single family. What we found, it's a lot easier to get financing and to get equity partners for multifamily properties as opposed to single family.
Sure, you know, scale and everything else.
Exactly. So it comes from the scale. I always, you know, I had mentors in the past that always told me, every time you add a zero, it's easier to raise money. It's easier to raise 500,000 versus 50. It's easier to raise 5 million versus 500. It's easier to raise 50 million instead of 5 million. I never really understood why until I actually started getting involved and seeing the same amount of underwriting. The people out there that have capital, they just want to put out large amounts of capital at one time as opposed to small little bits for a single family here, single family there, single family. Those were our first three single families. And we already had three multifamily buildings at that point.
Okay.
This is when I decided to start getting involved in self-storage. So about 3 years ago, walked into Scott Meyer's presentation in Indianapolis regarding self-storage, and it blew my mind. The things, the numbers he was presenting were crazy, but then also just all the headaches I was having from the multifamily properties. He was also saying that you don't have to worry about these in self-storage, right? No tenants, no toilets, no trash.
Yeah.
So then we started to get involved in, initially I wanted to, you know, feel comfortable with it, running the numbers. So the easiest way to feel comfortable running those numbers was to start wholesaling those properties. So we approached self-storage like a wholesaler would, with the marketing going direct to sellers, you know, finding these mom and pop owners that are in distressed situations, putting together multiple option offers, you know, cash offer, seller finance offer, long-term seller finance offer. And we actually wholesaled two properties. So that gave me validation that, hey, I'm running these numbers correctly, because there's cash buyers that are willing to buy these contracts off of me for these self-storage properties. I started doing the same thing. Started talking to the buyers of my self-storage facilities and seeing how much money they were making and how easy it was for them to put together the equity and the debt side on those facilities. And I was like, okay, this is what we have to start doing right away.
Let me ask you this, Fernando, because I've never wholesaled a self-storage facility. How much did you make when you wholesaled those couple properties? And then how much net cash flow were these operators generating once they stayed alive?
These are large wholesale fees, right? Because they're large facilities and your buyers are
more sophisticated because of the amount. So like a small self-storage facility is like $1 million, right?
Right.
So I think on our first one, we made like 40,000. And then the 40, second...
How many units was that first one?
I want to say like 118 units.
Okay.
On that one. So it's a very small facility. And then the second one was a little bit larger, a little over 200 units. I think we made a smaller fee on that one just to get rid of it. It wasn't in our local market. It was in the middle of Illinois as opposed to up here by Chicago. So that one, I think we made a $30,000 fee on that one. If my
Do you have any idea that those two buyers for those facilities, do you know what they were cash flowing?
Oh yeah, because I did all the numbers for them on actuals and on the pro forma. So these guys were making anywhere between 9 to 13% cap rates after our wholesale fee. And these were on value add properties. So, you know, they were 50%, you know, economic occupancy, or they had a bunch of room to build additional storage units on the land.
Got it. Okay. Amazing, man. And so once you wholesale these two properties, you kind of, I don't want to say you had proof of concept, but to a certain degree, it sounds like you had that validation, right? At that point, is that when you decided, hey, you know, we want to start taking these things down as operators now versus wholesaling them? Okay. Yep. And that was about what, 2.5-3 years ago? Like how long after Scott Myers boot camp did you end up closing on your first self-storage facility?
Yeah. So right after the boot camp, we did the two wholesale deals almost immediately within like 6 months or so. And then we purchased our first facility within, I want to say about a year, no, 2 years, maybe about 2 years after this is when we purchased our first facility. The reason why is we were really looking for the cream puffs. We saw that there's facilities that have a lot of opportunity, but on the first deal, I just wanted to make sure that, hey, just like on my first flip and on my first rental property, there was all these things I didn't account for that ended up coming in. So I wanted to make sure that, so we passed up a lot of good deals to find the one great one. So we ended up buying a facility. We partnered actually with the guy that partnered with me on my first fix and flip for that facility. We did, that's okay. So this is where I like start listing some of the crazy stats that self-storage has. So lenders love self-storage. They absolutely love self-storage. So just to prove it, on our first deal, we got a 20% down loan that was a 30-year fixed, fully amortized at 5.25% interest on a commercial loan.
That's sick.
And that's because the bank, they're like, we are more than willing to hold this on our books because the default rate of self-storage is the lowest out of everything on our books. And so that's,
I didn't know that.
So that spurred me to start doing a lot of research, and actually my March CG presentation will go over a little bit more of this in depth. But just to give you some rough stats. So between 2007 and 2009, self-storage dropped only 3.8% in that recession. You know what the S&P dropped during that time? 22% how much the S&P dropped. Mortgages dropped 19.5%. And then multifamily dropped 7%. So there was a huge spread just on safety for the bank. Of the assets that defaulted, they found that those were also the lowest losses per default. Between 2011 and 2018, self-storage had the lowest default rate versus any other asset class. And on those defaults, only 1.5% was lost on the loan on average across the entire surveyed population versus everything else. 1.5% is all that the bank lost. So they know these are very safe investments.
Sure.
Now let's look at the other side. So extremely recession tolerant, right? Which, you know, based on if you guys have been watching the market, I think there's going to be a little bit of another downturn coming here in the next 2 years or so. Perfect time to get into something that is known as a recession tolerant asset. On the flip side, let's talk returns, right? Because usually safer assets, usually have lower returns. Self-storage is the exact opposite. It also has the highest returns of all the asset classes. So between 1994 and 2017, self-storage returned an annual average of 17.43%. So that, just to put it into numbers, if you would have invested $100,000 in 1994, that'd be a little over $4 million in 2017.
So not only am I surprised it's the asset class with the least amount of risk from the bank's perspective, but it's also the asset class with the highest returns. I would not have thought that. That's super, super interesting to me.
Yeah. So in that same time, the S&P, when self-storage made 17.43%, the S&P 500 only made 7.5% average annual return. So just to kind of put things in perspective.
And is this a sample size across the entire country, or is this a particular?
Yes. So this is a survey done by the National Association of REITs. So they surveyed every REIT that were in the multiple asset classes to get these statistics.
Unbelievable, man. So when you saw Scott presenting those kind of numbers, I don't know, I'm assuming he presented similar numbers. That's when you were like, all right, I'm jumping in. Within 6 months, you wholesale two of these facilities. And then within a couple of years, you took down your first one, right?
Correct. Yeah, correct.
Got it. All you had to do was put down 20%. What was the purchase price on that first facility you guys took down?
Yeah, so that facility was a $970,000 purchase price. I also got to put a $30,000 acquisition fee on top of it. So nice. I got to wholesale the deal to myself, basically. So Amazing. Let's call it total $1 million. And then we put the 20% down, not even as cash. So one of our partners had farmland that he had inherited. We decided to 1031 exchange that farmland into a like stable multifamily, uh-huh. and then use those stable multifamily properties fully, you know, no leverage on them as the down payment on the self-storage facility.
Wow. So you didn't have
crazy,
to
crazy, just creative techniques.
You didn't have to put a penny out of your pocket to get into this facility. You put 30 grand in your pocket as an acquisitions fee, got into the deal. And so was this particular property, you know, was it, I don't know if in self-storage, do you guys use the term stabilized?
Right. So I'll give you exactly what the self-storage facility was. So it was technically stabilized, but it still had a very large value add component. So it was at 100% occupancy. Uh-huh. But what we found is the guy that built it and who has owned it for the last 30 years, he never raised rents. So if anybody started renting, that was their rate for life. So when we started surveying the rent rolls, we found that on average, the facility was at 40% below market. So there's an increase right there to the bottom line just by sending a letter saying, guess what? This month, your rent's going up, right?
What a huge opportunity.
Oh, man. And the second thing that we found was that all of the tenants only had one way to pay. They would wait for a physical invoice to be mailed to them each month, and then they would have to write a check back to the facility that had an unlocked mailbox on the property. No office, nothing.
Stop it. I don't believe you. Are you serious?
Swear. And then after that, we also found that they had no internet presence. You couldn't find them on Google. They didn't have a website. There's no other ways to pay, no management software. The guy was basically running his entire business off of a like notepad and paper. I think he had like an old school DOS like management system that he ran like with the blue screen and everything.
God bless. And he probably still was cash flowing even with all that.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. And he built it. So, you know, it's all profit. So we ended up buying it at a 7.75% cap rate. And then immediately we created a website. We created online presence. We added ways for tenants to pay with credit card, money order, ACH, debit, direct deposit, you name it, right?
Yeah.
And then we also raised the rents 40%. And we're still at 100% occupancy. We bought it at $1 million about, you know, 6 or so months ago, and we're about to get it reappraised to do a cash out refinance. And it's going to probably come in around 1.5, 1.6 million.
Wow, man. Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. And when you guys do a cash out refi, is it going to change your cash flow numbers at all?
Yeah, it's going to change them. So the reason we're doing the cash out refinance is because we're going to build additional units.
Okay.
So we found that this is such a cream puff deal. We looked at the local area and the demand is over double of what the supply is. So there's a way to calculate this. It's called a supply index number. You look at the net rentable square feet per capita. So net rentable square feet divided by the amount of people in your trade area. For us, it's 3 mile radius.
Okay.
And if you're below 7, that means there's unmet demand, and ours came below 3. So that means we could double the amount of units and still not meet the total demand for self-storage in the area.
Unbelievable. So with that data, are you guys now laser focused on acquiring more facilities in that 3 mile radius?
Yeah. So in that area, we are building an additional 80 to 100 units. We're also looking at the competitors to see if they're willing to sell. But the nice thing about self-storage, it's such a localized business that you can go anywhere and find these little pockets. So we're building a 596-unit facility in the northwest suburbs. We're building a 850-unit facility in the western suburbs. We're looking at building a 773-unit facility in the northern suburbs of Chicago. We're also expanding out. So that bank that gave us the leverage, that the phenomenal mm-hmm. terms on that self-storage deal, they only lend in 8 states. So we're heavily targeting those 8 states. And yeah. then on top of those 8 states, we're targeting another 20 states that are the lowest tax states in the United States. And the reason we do this, property tax states. So the reason we do this is because self-storage has basically no, very low expenses. You know, there's not a lot of plumbing. There's not a lot of electricity. There's no HVAC. Very low expenses. Your highest expense item is property taxes. So the easiest way to get a higher cash flow in property is just to buy in places that have low property taxes.
That is so awesome. Fernando, are all of these, the markets that you guys are targeting, are these all the Midwest?
No, not necessarily. So the Midwest is the initial 8 because of the bank that we work with. But then we're targeting all the lowest tax states. So like, Texas is one of those. Florida is one of those. So it's really all over the country.
Got it. Unbelievable, man. And all the while, you guys still have your wholesale operation running, right?
Yeah. So we finally were blessed that we have put a lot of great people in place, a lot of great processes and procedures. So now me, Fernando Angelucci, as the individual, I'm hardly involved in our wholesale business from the day-to-day operations. The rest of the team handles it for us. And it still kicks out a lot of great deals. You know, even though that we don't do flips and rentals anymore, we have 6,100 buyers in the Chicagoland area that are looking for those types of deals still. So we will gladly find them. And I think it even gives us an advantage over other wholesalers that are doing their own flips and rentals, because we're not cherry picking the best deals for ourselves.
Yeah,
we only do self-storage now. So all the great deals, we just pass on the savings to our investors.
Absolutely. Actually,
fellow CG guy just bought a deal off of us. So,
oh, really nice.
Yeah.
Very, very cool, dude. And so do you have like a COO or an integrator in place there running the operation? You know, somebody that's hands-on and that's what they do full time?
Yeah. So we don't have a full-time integrator, but we do have full-time acquisition manager. We're hiring another acquisition manager. We have a lead manager. We're hiring another lead manager. We have just kind of the contractor network around us. So the attorneys, the it's crazy. You know, I always tell the wholesalers this, really go to all these networking events, because once you get the momentum, close to 30% of our deals are referral deals from either wholesalers that I've taught or attorneys or title agents. They just bring the deals. They're like, hey, Fernando, remember that you buy properties for cash. Like, can you help this person out that I met? You know, I don't need anything, but we always, you know, the way that we do everything is 50-50. So even if somebody says, hey, you don't need to pay me out, I still will send them a check for 50% of the wholesale fee.
Really? You get 50%.
Yep. So the way that we work is if you bring, the way that we look at it is there's two parties to a wholesale deal. There's a cash buyer and then there's a seller. If you bring the seller, you're doing 50% of the work for us. So if we bring the cash buyer, we take 50%, right?
Wow. So having said that, it's no surprise to me that people are 30% of your wholesale business is from referrals, because, you know, most people will pay $500, $1,000, $2,000 referral fees, while here you are giving up half the deal, you know?
Yeah, and now our average wholesale fee is $17,000. So when these guys come, you know, there's all these wholesalers around, you know, who are they going to think of first? They're always going to call Titan Wealth Group first, because we're the most abundant with our time. We're the most abundant with our fees. You know, everything I do is based on a fair partnership. I always want to do everything right down the middle, because then nobody can complain that someone's doing more work than the other person. We're all working towards a common goal, and we're both going to make the same amount of money regardless of what happens.
That's unbelievable, dude. So as we start to kind of wind down the show here, you got a fascinating story, and I'm glad we connected, because I think we just have so many similar traits and just especially mindset. Two questions I want to ask you, because the theme of partnerships has come up a lot in this episode, and I've heard horror stories of just partnerships gone south, you know, business partnerships and JV partnerships, right? So two-part question. I'm going to toss them at you at once. First one is, what advice do you have for people that are gun shy to get involved with partnerships, and how have you been able to make them work so successfully throughout the last 5-6 years? And then number two, you're a young dude, man. You're only 27, so maybe this question is not as applicable, but rewind the clock to when you first got started, or right before you first got started, knowing what you know now, what's the one piece of advice that you would have shared with yourself? So two questions, I'll kind of let you marinate on the second one, but talk to me about partnerships and how you've been able to just make them work so successfully.
Yeah. So I think number one is you really need to first sit down with your potential partner and figure out what their true goals are, right? If you're looking to build a long-term rental portfolio, but the partner's only looking to cash in, cash out, maybe that's not the best partnership. Second thing that I always look at, so specifically on the business partnership, is you need to find somebody that has the exact opposite traits as you do. This is going to help you, because then instead of you guys both being good sales guy, but neither of you guys are good, say, integrators or good, you know, administrative people, you're going to start having issues and butting heads. So what I have found is it's always best to find a partner that has similar goals and has complementary skill set to you, right? This is going to be huge. The second thing is you got to make sure that you can get along with this person. Maybe they hit those two boxes, but you just don't like the person's personality in general. So it really comes down to, do your values align? You know, our values in my company are, I have 5, and they are true for everyone that I work with. And if you don't fit that, then I'm probably not going to partner with you. Number one, and this is number one. Number one is I like to play hard. So I work very hard and I play even harder, right? So I don't want some tight bred guy that's like, oh, Fernando, like, why are you drinking at 10 p.m.? It's because, like, I like to have fun.
Yeah, yeah.
So the only reason we're doing this is because we like to have fun. So if somebody is, you know, a stick in the mud kind of partner that's very dry and doesn't like to enjoy it, that's probably not going to work, right? Second thing with me is integrity. I will not work with liars. I don't work with people that are shady. I don't work with people that are always trying to make an extra buck on someone else. That those partnerships end very, very quickly, because if you operate with integrity, it's really easy to operate. I never have to be worrying about, oh, did I lie to this guy? And did I tell this guy this? Like, that just seems like too much work. When I can just be authentic, I don't have to worry about that.
That's right.
Another thing is be generous. I like to be abundant with my time. I like to be abundant with my money. We always do volunteer things. We always donate money. Generous Genius is also a great thing that we just, you know, because we just joined, that have been a fantastic outlet for us to do that as well. Mm-hmm. If I find someone that's not generous, for example, and there's little ways, I tell, like, for example, when I have wholesalers that want me to mentor them, you know, they'll bring me a deal and they'll say, hey, I got this deal. Like, you can market this out, you know, just add your fee on top. And I was like, that's not how we work. Cause now all of a sudden you're not being generous. You needed my help, but you're not willing to give me anything of that. There's a deal that you weren't going to be able to sell without me, but you don't want me to make any money for my time. And now you're trying to put me in a bad position compared to my cash buyers. What if they see the deal come from me, but they saw it from you at a lower price? That doesn't make sense.
And they will, by the way. So you never want to add your fee to somebody else's deal. Right. Don't do that.
Always market at the same price, right? Same thing with being generous with time. Like, for example, easiest way that I screen people is I take them to my neighborhood bar. It's like my version of Cheers. Like, shout out to Side Street Saloon. I go there, and the bartender is one of my good friends. And usually these people will say, hey, Fernando, let me pick your brain. You know, I'll buy you a beer or whatever. And then afterwards, I'll always, you know, check in with Sean and say, hey, did they tip you well? And he'd be like, no, man, they didn't tip me at all. And I was like, oh, that's not a generous person. I'm out.
I love that. Love that.
And it's true. If you want to see how someone truly will treat the partners when tough times are ahead, look at how they treat people that they don't think are worth their time. Waiters, you know, servers. If they're not generous with those people, why do you think they're going to be generous with somebody like you when times get tough?
Fernando, what's really cool about what you're sharing here is that core value alignment is so important when you, not just with your partners, but with your clients, your inner circle, your employees, your team members. Yeah. But you've taken it a step further where you don't just take it at face value, but you actually put it to the test, you know, and that's awesome, man.
Yeah, because people always tell you they're the best, right? They're the nicest, they never lie. Right. But you want to see it in action. So there's actually been already a few partnerships that I ended because of that exact reason. They are potential partnerships that I didn't get into because they, you know, all of a sudden I found out that, you know, they offered to pay for my, you know, my time and to buy me a beer. And I told them everything about my company and I gave them all these resources. And then all of a sudden, you know, they, and it's funny because it's not like, oh, this is just some guy. So I was like, this is one of my good friends, Sean. He bartends where we're going to meet, right? So they know right off the bat that this is somebody in my network, my sphere of influence. Yeah. And then they're still going to short him on a tip. Like, that's crazy,
stupid.
You know?
Yeah, it's stupid, yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, but that's, you know, that's fine. They can find another partner that might align with their values, but it's just not for me.
Okay. And then what about the second?
So the second one, so there's a few things, if I can answer this with a few different answers. So number one is I wish I would have started earlier with the waking up extremely early and doing a morning routine. You know, coming right out of college, I was still on that college schedule where I'd go to sleep at midnight or 1 a.m. and wake up, you know, sleep deprived. What I found is that sleep is extremely important. It's how your brain functions. It's how it cleans itself, right? I always aim for 8.5 hours a night. And then I usually have to go to sleep early around 9:30, you know, 9 to 10 o'clock, so that I can get up before everybody else is up, so I can get the main tasks done for the day before, you know, around 8:30, my phone is blowing up. I can't get it. Like, I put my phone on silent during this interview. I've already gotten like 15, 16 calls. So, you know, you can't focus and work. You know, I always tell people, work on the business, not in the business. Work on creating procedures, work on creating processes and hiring and delegating. These things take a lot of thought and takes a lot of focus. And when you're answering the phone, because there's fires every 15 minutes.
You can't get enough. And studies have shown, Fernando, that I think it takes you up to like 20 or 30 minutes just to refocus on whatever you were working on prior to the interruption. So totally agree with you, man. 100%. I've recorded a lot of podcast episodes on my morning routine, and I'm always fascinated connecting with successful people. Most, if not every single one of them, has some sort of morning routine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mine's pretty easy. I wake up early, go get some coffee or tea. Then I'll do a little bit of meditation. I'll do a little bit of journaling, writing down, just getting my thoughts straightened out and onto paper from out of my head. And then I read. Reading is super important. I think I have an advantage over a lot of investors because I read every day and I'm reading about new strategies and ways to do things creatively and reading about taxes and finance. It's one of those things that I think is super important. You read 10 pages a day, that's 10 books a year.
Yeah. What time do you get up in the morning?
Usually anywhere between 6 and 6:30. It depends on what part of the cycle I'm in. So like when times are slower, I'll be out later during doing networking events. And unfortunately, these networking events for real estate investors, they usually start at like 8 o'clock and then go to midnight. But during the times where we're really busy, like spring, summer, fall, you know, I'm going to sleep a lot earlier. I'm going to sleep. There's sometimes, you know, when I got back, I was going to sleep at like 8:30, waking up at 3:30 in the morning. And it was crazy because Ben, by the time 8:30 rolled around, I already had 5 hours of work that was done. I already felt like I accomplished everything I needed to accomplish for the day. And I still had like another.
Yeah, dude, you've done more than 95% of people out there, maybe 99% of people out there when you wake up at that time. So yeah, I get it, man. So 3 days a week, I do a pretty intense workout where the class starts at 5 a.m. I'm up at 4, just kind of stretching, meditating. By the time it's 7:30 rolls around, I've worked out, I've stretched, I've meditated, I've read, I've had breakfast, and I'm like, my day is just so different on those days versus the days that I just wake up later and I'm kind of behind. You have that feeling where you're behind the eight ball a little bit, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. My only difference from yours is that I moved my workouts from the morning to early afternoon. The reason I did that is I found that just by going I do powerlifting, so very heavy lifting 5 days a week. What I do is I go around usually 12:30, 1 p.m. I'm at the gym for about an hour and a half. And then when I get back, I find that I am have more energy where I would usually be tapering off around 3:30. Now I could go till 6:30, still have the energy. I think it's something about getting the blood flow, extra oxygen to the brain right in the middle of the day when most people are getting the yawns and going for their afternoon coffee. Yeah. I use the workout as like my cup of coffee in the afternoon. So it works really well for me.
This is a perfect way, I think, to put a bow on this episode. It kind of comes back to one of the things that we talked about at the beginning is being self-aware, you know, these success hacks and setting up your environment to, you know, to make sure that you accomplish your goals. And for you, you found out that the morning workout isn't the best. It's an afternoon workout because now you can stretch out your day an extra 3 or 4 hours, you know? So that's awesome. You know, I encourage everybody listening out there, test, you know, try what Fernando's doing, try what I do, figure out what works for you. And, you know, treat life as an experiment at times, you know, and figure out it's not one size fits all. Success has many different paths. So take something Fernando has shared with you. I love the fact that he's so self-aware. I love your abundant mentality and the fact that you're so generous with your time, your money, your expertise. And it shows, man, it's come back to you, and it's no reason. You're 27 years old, you know, super successful wholesaling operation. You've acquired these self-storage facilities, and dude, you're killing it, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it, Alex.
Amazing, buddy. So how do people connect with you, reach out, maybe if they're in one of the markets where you guys operate in, and, you know, just obviously you're open to joint ventures and partnerships. So where's the best place that people reach out to you, and hopefully someone listening to this episode can connect with you on some deals?
Yeah. So my partner, Steven, hates when I do this, but I put my money where my mouth is. So I'll just give you guys my cell phone number. My cell phone number is 308-0-8090. Yeah, I'll repeat it again. 408-8090. Shoot me a text message, the easiest way to get a hold of me. In the text, just put your full name and your email address so I can save you in my phone. And then if you want to talk on the phone, usually after hours is the best time to reach me. Like live answer would be usually after like 6 p.m. The other easy ways to access us, if you're a little shy of just reaching out directly, is, you know, go to our website, titanwealthgroup.com. Find us on social media, you know, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all at Titan Wealth Group. We're very active out there, and, you know, I love talking to new investors. I remember when I was a new investor and somebody took me under their wing. It's a great feeling to have somebody that knows what they're doing, offer guidance, and just even be able to just shoot a text here, there, being like, "Hey, I'm looking at this deal. Here are the numbers. What do you think?" Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I do this on every podcast I go onto. My partner hates it when I do it, but it's, I mean, you'll see, shoot me a text right now. If you're listening to this right now, shoot me a text. I guarantee you I'll answer.
Dude, you're a bold man, and I respect it, man. I absolutely respect it. So actually, do me one quick favor. Run it back, because I was kind of, you know, speaking over you, and I want to make sure. We'll include the phone number in the show notes. But by the way, your partner's going to hate me for doing this, but run back your phone number one more time.
It's 630-408-8090.
Awesome. Well, Fernando, man, thank you. I acknowledge you. You and I, you know, in full transparency here for everybody listening. Usually I have people on the show that I know very, very well. And you know, we're in the same family. And, you know, I know that if you're in that family, you come with integrity and you obviously know what you're doing. So I'm glad we connected and you got on the show. I know now we've built a friendship and a connection moving forward. I know we'll see each other here. Probably at the time that this episode is being released, you and I might be together, or, you know, within a week or so. So I'm excited for people to listen to your story and take away just a lot of what has made you who you are, and a lot of the reasons that you're successful.
Yeah. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Alex.
No, buddy. Thank you. And guys, I appreciate you for tuning into another episode. You know, I do this because I love to give back. I love to talk shop with successful, like-minded people like Fernando. And if you have any questions, reach out to me. You know, taking a page from Fernando's book, we have the Ask Alex link on flipempire.com. Any questions you have, guys, you know that you can fire them over my way. And I'm happy to create an episode and answer that question. So, love you guys.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show. But we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.